edition of the Armchair Directors. For each episode, we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at the Coen brothers and their 1991 film, Barton Fink. Returning on the show today to talk about Barton Fink is Professor Mary Dutter. Professor Dutter, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much.
So I've seen this film twice now. This is the first time I've seen this in about 5-6 years. It's a film that I do enjoy and I do like, but it's one of those things I'm not quite 100% sure I get what they were going for. It seems that they were juggling a lot of themes in this movie, and we'll definitely get into that. And to some of them seem to hit more than others, and I definitely want to get your opinion on it.
Well, I actually like the way that you just put that whole some of the things hit better than others, because for me, I think that has a lot to do with my appreciation for and sometimes frustration with Coen Brothers films, because there are some times where they're just so on and so good, and there are other times where I'm like, what are you doing? Just literally, what are you doing? and this movie hits a lot. I don't have any misses with this, but I definitely can't say the same thing with a number of their other movies. It was interesting because this morning I was looking up, GQ had ranked all the Coen Brothers films, and it was right at the time that Hail Caesar was coming out. And you'll see people, when they kind of try to rank their films, you know, talk about the ones that they get really right and the ones that they get really wrong. And those fluctuate from person to person, so you can't always block out a particular one, although it's hard to find somebody that will defend Burn After Reading.
Burn After Reading?
Do you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't love it, but I think it's a funny film.
Okay, well, maybe we could do another show on that one, because I'm actually doing a Coen Brothers class for the OSHA program, and that's one of the movies that we're doing, so we can revisit Burn After Reading at some point.
Sure.
And George Clooney's wacky ways when he gets involved with the Coen brothers. Personally for me, Barton Fink came out the year I graduated from high school, 1991, and I was hanging around a couple of people that were really, really super into acting and film. And one of my friends said, okay, we simply have to go and see this. And it blew my mind, being somebody that was getting ready to go to college and study literature. The character that, what is his name, Mahoney plays?
W.P. Mayhew? That's his character's name, yeah.
Yeah, the kind of the extreme version of a William Faulkner or an F. Scott Fitzgerald, the kind of writer that was drawn to Hollywood because they were supposed to make just tons and tons of money writing these screenplays, because at the time, Hollywood was kind of running dry on ideas, and they just needed as much influx of talent as possible. So that character, the W.P. Mayhew character, and so that literary part of it, I really kind of gleaned onto. And the whole fact that it's one of these movies that's about making movies, which I'm a sucker for. I know there's some people that really, really hate movies that are about movies. And so it's kind of interesting to see this one with something like Hail Caesar, where you have that sort of reflexive narrative going on, where it's a movie about making a movie, but also you have other plot elements that are obviously in play. John Turturro won Best Actor at the Cannes Film Festival. This won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. Joel and Ethan Coen won Best Director. There's a lot about this movie that is so typical of the Coen brothers. It's not for a mass audience. There will probably be a lot of people that would watch this and be like, what the heck was that? But for the geekies and the Coen brother fanboys and fangirls, this definitely hits a sweet spot.
Yeah, and it does have, like you said, like even you talked about Hail Caesar, both films are of Capital Pictures.
Yes.
So you have that little connection. But yeah, it is very Coen Brothers. It's not only are they using their usual core of actors like Turturro and Goodman, But this was also the very first film they did with Roger Deakins as the cinematographer.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, Coen brothers, you watch a lot of their films, you can tell they have this love of golden age of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. You know, they do a lot of that where, you know, their movies are either noirs or they're like either screwball comedies or they're even just like a Capra films, like something out of Hudsucker Proxy. So they always kind of go back to that golden age of Hollywood with their movies.
Yeah. And another thing, too, that I just find just devastating about this film is its art direction. I mean, you go from the really, really bright world of the Hollywood studio mogul, you know, the character that Michael Lerner plays, you know, John Lipdek, who is kind of an amalgam of all the kind of big, stuff-shirted, overly important Hollywood executives, and he's got his house and his pool, and he's got this big, bright office, and you have that juxtaposed with the hotel that Barton Fink is staying in and the John Goodman character is staying in, and it's so dark and it's so oppressive and so saturated in this sort of velvet layers of dust and Chet. And, you know, it's just, it's so weird because you have that whole golden, glamorous Hollywood that just seems right outside the doorway of that space that Barton Fink is living in, and yet he spends a lot of time just cloistered away in that room with the wallpaper just kind of curling off the wall and the glue running down in gobs. And it's just the environments that are created in Coen Brothers movies, even the ones that I don't particularly like, are just amazing. They're just stunning. They're almost kind of Lynchian to me. That's a good one. Yeah. So much time and effort spent on some of the smallest details. Like the opening and closing shot is just that holding on that what looks to be wallpaper. It's not even the wallpaper that's in Fink's room, but this sort of kind of fantail, glamorous, almost kind of a throwback to 1920s, even though the film is supposed to be set in 1941. And that's just the opening and closing, you know, areas of the film. We don't really see that pattern again throughout the entire movie. It's just, that's a throwaway, but it's not. So I adore their attention to detail with what they do with their set designs and their set designers and what they do. And of course, you've got obviously Roger Deakins, who is God, filming this just amazing. And if you know anything about Roger Deakins, you know how crazy he is about his lighting setups and how he builds his own lighting setups. And just looking at what's going on, again, with exterior shots, with, you know, picnics with Mayhew and going out to the pool and the interior shots, it's just there's so much to appreciate just on a technical level.
I mean, even you get the great opening take where we're watching his play and we're slowly following like one of the levees of the curtains being drawn up and going down, and even see that later on when it's the love scene and we just sort of move away from the bedroom and go into the bathroom and the camera goes up and down and through the drain. I mean, oh man, that's just great Deakins right there.
Yeah. Yeah, you're totally inside that world to the point of where, you know, when they're in that hallway and the hallway catches fire and John Goodman is running down the hallway with a shotgun and it's just everything is bursting into flames. Everybody is just sweating from every single pore, and you're just like, you could be sitting in a room that maybe was 65 degrees, and you will be like, it's hot.
Yeah.
You feel hot because you're looking at this and you're just like, there's no way you cannot feel that. And the color palettes that are used, again, that's something else. It's just like really stunningly great when you look at, say, the color palette of Fargo versus the color palette of No Country for Old Men and how that psychologically works on you as an audience throughout the entire experience. It's just, it's amazing.
Yeah, and it's like the whole movie really feels like a jumbling of a lot of different genres.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of film. There's a bit of film noir, especially when the twist that John spoiler alert, that John Goodman's actually a murderer, and then you have the cops come in, and there's a lot of screwball comedy, special, like the all the stuff. They're big Preston Sturges fans, like Sullivan's Travels had a book called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? So you can see where they get that from. So it's a lot of comedy, and there's also a bit of horror, because a lot, basically that whole hotel reminded me of The Overlook and The Shining. It's very creepy, ominous. It's both movies are about this, you know, struggling writer inside this hotel room.
Right.
There's all these creepy things he's hearing. So it's very kind of, it's like a bit of horror, a bit of comedy, a bit of noir.
Yeah. Well, the class that I'm going to be teaching is kind of looking at how the Coen brothers like to mess with genre. So they'll have something like The Man Who Wasn't There. When you look at it, looks like this is what a noir is supposed to be. Until you get to the end and it turns into a science fiction movie.
Yeah.
And I'm putting Barton Fink into the noir space for obvious reasons. But like you're saying, there's so many other little things that are going on inside this movie that it's not just a classic snap fit that everything just works on that level. But even like the dialogue, one of the great conventions of dialogue in film noir is just the snappiness of it, that back and forth. And when you get the cops that come in,
oh yeah,
and I love their exchanges, you know, because that sounds to me like I'm listening to Raymond Chandler, you know. But that's not something that's always consistent throughout the film. When you look at how Charlie and Barton talk to each other, or the fact that Barton's talking and not listening to Charlie, which becomes a much bigger problem. You know, that doesn't sound like, I mean, even though some of the things that Charlie says are sometimes kind of poetic the way he says them, you know, Barton is so much about the life of the mind, the artist, and even though he's sitting there most of the movie going, you know, that's not art, art is the real man. You know, he has no clue what that is. And even when you have times where Charlie, who is the real man, supposedly is supposed to be trying to tell him, he won't listen. So there's a lot of things going on that I wouldn't necessarily categorize as noir-ish. But there's enough here that makes me want to explore it more as noir, because literally Barton really has no control over his situation. Even though the fact that he can't work out what's supposed to happen with this screenplay, and he has no clue what a wrestling picture looks like, he's even more out of sorts than what we normally see with a protagonist in a noir film, and he has so very little agency. The femme fatale, I mean, there's only one woman walking around in this movie, so it's hard for...
Yeah, she's not really a femme fatale.
Yeah, she's not a femme fatale. She is kind of a seductress, but I think overall, if you really had to put a femme fatale on anything, you would have to say it's John Goodman, and that's a conversation in and of itself, because he's obviously the biggest problem for Barton in this film, but also the thing that kind of drags him down at the end. But I had somebody explain a really interesting theory about that, so maybe after a couple more questions, I'll try to unpack that.
Yeah, because you touched on, I think, the biggest like part of the film that really comes out for me is the character of Barton Fink, how he's constantly about, I don't want to make these stories about like these people of royalty or these rich people or these politicians or whatever. I want to make movies or stories about the common man. Like his play was about like people who work, you know, in the fish hatcheries or something. He's always about the common man. And then he meets John Goodman, and he's telling him, like, oh, I make stories about you. You're the common man. And then whenever John Goodman's trying to tell him, well, you know, here's the story I could tell you, or here's the story I was at work today, he doesn't listen to him. He just interrupts him, and he just goes on about, well, I make stories about the common man. So the common man is always right in his face, willing to tell him stories, and yet he doesn't listen. So it almost seems like they're sort of mocking intellectuals who think they know what it is about being like, you know, the middle class or lower middle class or whatever, but yet they won't listen to them. They don't really go out of their way to actually study, well, what is it like to be somebody of the lower middle class?
Yeah, and I think that's something that is so interesting coming out of these two filmmakers' work, because Joel and Ethan Coen don't make movies for the common man.
No.
When you look at their filmography and you look at things like, well, how much money did these movies gross? You know, unless you're looking at something like A No Country for Old Men or A True Grit, these guys aren't making a ton of money off these films. They have a very, very specific audience that has a certain level of expectation. And while some of the characters that walk around in their films are, by and large, common men and women, whether they're police officers or, not bank robbers, but, you know, common thugs. It's funny to see the Coen brothers kind of picking at the snootiness of the Totoro character when essentially they are that character.
It almost feels like, in a way, because I know Barton, I was doing some research, Barton Fink is somewhat based on a playwright named Clifford Odets. And if you even see the pictures, like, he looks exactly like Barton Fink. He's got the...
Oh, is that right?
He's got the crazy hair. He's got the glasses. And he was a big famous playwright. And I think even he kind of considered himself this intellectual who wanted to, you know, once again, make stories about the common man. So I wonder if, in a way, they're making a commentary about, you know, the theater and the film, in the world of theater and film, how, you know, you think you know the common people, but you don't, and maybe you're not as, because of that, maybe you're not as intellectual or sophisticated as you think if you don't really know what your story is are about.
Right, and you know what's interesting too is that, you know, there's a couple of people, not just Charlie, but there's a couple of people that really do kind of try to inform Barton about what is going wrong with his process. And you know, this idea that he wants to write these really, really important things that are going to touch people deeply, and he's forced to make a wrestling picture. And, you know, another one of the characters who I love the way he is acted in this movie and the lines that they gave him, the Ben Geisler character, the Tony Shalhoub character.
Oh, yeah, he's great.
I adore him every single time he's on the screen because he just totally steals everything. But, you know, he just says, you know, he's working in pictures, but he's also an incredibly pragmatic person. You know, he's having to filter everything Liptak is saying to him, or Lipnick is saying to him, but he still has to come up with the finished product at the end of the day. So whereas Liptak or Lipnick is saying, we don't make B pictures, that's not what we do here, let me get that out of the way right now. And then some of the first things that come out of Geisler's mouth are, it's a wrestling picture. It's a B picture. That's all we do here. Do this, do this, do this, and get on with it. Just go.
Yeah.
That's being very much in touch with this notion of a common man, where you're given something that you have to do, and you go and do it because it's your job. This is how you're getting paid every day. And, you know, to go and then turn around and see what the studio's version of what common men want to watch, which is this wrestling picture where the guy's like, I will destroy you, cut, and then you see, like, this horrible reenactment of what they think a wrestling match might look like, which isn't anything like that, especially when you juxtapose it with what John Goodman does and how fast he's able to pin Barton when they're just kind of messing around in their room. So it's like, there's so many skewed versions of, well, who is the common man, and what is the common man looking for? You know, Chet. Look at Chet. It almost seems like Chet never leaves the hotel. Like, he's there.
He even lives under that little area under the reception desk.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just like, you know, if you call him in the middle of the night or late at night to complain that the person that's living next to you is making too much noise, Chet's going to answer the phone on the first ring. Like,
and he constantly tells you his name is Chet.
Yeah, and you know, he's always kind of trying to enforce his identity. I mean, he says his name is Chet like 5 times in a really brief exchange.
And he even writes it down for him.
Yeah, and with a cute little exclamation point. I mean, it's so awesome. It's just like, here I am. Here's the common man right here.
Yeah, and that little part with Buscemi is like classic Coen brothers.
Yeah.
Like, I'm Chet. Oh, by the way, you take my card. Here's my name, Chet.
Chet. And it's just perfect. But it's like, well, there's another version of the common man. You know, what's happening in Chet's world? That might be an incredibly more interesting story than what's going on with Barton or with Mayhew, who's just getting drunk over and over and over again. So I don't know. There's just so many little things that, I mean, just Barton overall is not, he may be a great writer. We never really get to see much in the way of his words other than that whole, we're going to hear from that kid, and I don't mean a postcard. I mean, that we get that line like three different times on page and spoken. He could be a great author, but anybody that is so bad at not being able to observe the world around him the way Barton is, it's hard to imagine that he would be a good writer. Because a lot of what happens with writing is your ability to observe and just take in the world around you to be able to use it to your advantage. And he can't see anything. He just misses everything.
Yeah, that's another thing. It's like he literally has this guy wanting to tell him stories, a common man willing to tell him stories, mm-hmm. and he doesn't even bother listening. He could, there's like, even with all the crazy things going around the hotel, there's so many things he could use, but he doesn't. And it's like what Jod Goodman screams at the end, because you don't listen.
Yeah, I just love that. I love that when that happens in that movie, because it's just the ultimate, this is your problem at heart, inherently. You are this problem. And, you know, then you can kind of take it more to a macro position. You know, there's a lot of times in society where the common man isn't listened to, that they're, you know, not listened to politically or not listened to financially or not listened to socially. And but you've got people like who Barton Fink is and the, you know, executives at the studio trying to put out entertainment for these so-called common men as an audience. And we know they'll probably go see the wrestling picture. We know they're not going to go see Barton's play. You know, in 1941, you know, right at the time where the war is beginning, because we get that scene in the USO where Barton tries to explain to the soldiers that are going off to fight and die how important he is. I mean, yet again, another instance where Barton can't get it. Just like, Barton, oh my God, he's just so self-absorbed that it's just almost, it's not almost, it's sickening. It's really kind of gross.
Yeah, definitely. And while I think that part, this element of the film really comes through, because there's been a lot of other elements people say, because one of the things that I didn't quite feel a lot was like the, you know, like you said, we're on the eve of World War II. That one of the very end, last scenes in the movie is when he goes back to Lipnick's office, and he's now dressed up in a colonel's gear because Pearl Harbor just happened.
Yeah, and his costume, people were able to get that together for him right away.
Yeah. And so you get that, and then you also get a lot of, you know, the anti-Semitism, because Fink is Jewish.
Oh, yeah.
And then you got the cops making anti-Semitic remarks, like, oh, I had a feeling this place wasn't restricted. And then at the very end, you have John Goodman, you know, saying Heil Hitler as he kills one of the cops.
Yeah.
And I didn't quite get what all of that was coming to with, you know, that part didn't come out nearly as strongly for me as the fact that, you know, the self-absorbed intellectualness of Barton Fink.
Well, there's a lot of inside baseball going on in this movie, and it has a whole different layer. And, like, the fact that Lipnick, who is clearly Jewish, is calling his Lou Breeze, his little office flunky, a kike, and he's calling Barton a kike, but he himself is a Jew, is kind of going back to, and again, it's like it's inside baseball. There was this whole thing that was happening in Hollywood before we got involved in World War II about how the fact that most of the studio heads in Hollywood were Jewish. And there was a lot of kerfuffle because some of them really wanted to react to what was happening in Europe and what was starting to become known about the concentration camps. And others were like, no, we can't comment on that. We can't make movies that talk about that because, of course, a large portion of the country were German immigrants and Italian immigrants. You know, a significant portion of Japanese American immigrants, and they didn't want to alienate their audience or piss people off. And of course, there was a ton of people at that time that was like, look, we got involved in World War I. We really didn't see any anything good come out of that? Yeah. Why do we want to get into Europe's problems? So there's this overall fear in Hollywood, especially amongst the Jewish studio heads and the producers, about, you know, are we able to say anything or do anything about this? And there was a lot of anti-Semitism, even though the people that were in charge at the time were Jewish. So this whole fact that Lipnick is able to throw slurs out, even though he's part of that group, kind of speaks to that. And so the fact that also after the bombs drop, he's got a uniform on before he's even been cleared for any kind of activity, because, you know, he can put it on and finally show his stripes. That kind of goes into some of the elements that they go into throughout the movie about this being Hollywood in 1941.
It's a good point. You know, so you got that. And then one of the other things that really kind of confused me was sort of this, we get the final scene when he's on the beach. He sees the girl. He asks her if she's in pictures, and she just kind of laughs it off. And then she strikes the pose that's been in that picture in his hotel room,
right,
for so long. And then you get the final shot of like the bird falling down, dying onto the water. And I think some people kind of said it's sort of like a symbolic of like escapism, that he wants to escape to that part. You know, that shot, to see that. That's another thing that kind of confused me about this movie. I'm like, is it trying to escape? But what is he escaping from? Is he escaping from the hotel? Is he escaping from the film contract?
I think this really doesn't have that much to do with him as it does with movies, because the whole time you're seeing that picture on his wall, right above his wall, it's in a frame. And that is what a movie is. It's a picture in a frame. It's a moving picture in a frame, but you always have that very clear delineation of here's where the screen is and here's where life is. And for me, the fact that he, and as, of course, when you look at it, where it's positioned on the wall above his typewriter, it's kind of like how you look up at a movie screen. And there's a lot of times where he's looking up at that picture probably as a means of escape, but that's, of course, a lot of times when people go to the movies, they're looking for escape. So the fact that this whole exercise of going and watching this movie, which is not real, obviously, but is based on things like humanity and human truths, you know, people don't want to fail once they've had a success. People don't want to be cast aside. You've got the whole subplot of what happens with Audrey's character. Here you have this woman who is with this alcoholic. She has written some of his greatest works, and no one will ever know. And all Mayhew does is insult her and treat her like some kind of wash rag. And Barton really doesn't do all that much better, honestly. He's just not drunk at the time, you know, but He's not all that great with her. The fact that he finds out that she's written a lot of his stuff, instead of him saying, like, oh, my God, you're an amazing writer. This is incredible.
He's like, you
can
help me.
Wonderful you are. Yeah. Instead of that, he's just like, that son of a bitch. I can't believe that I've been, you know, hoodwinked by this person that's supposedly so great. So when Barton finally walks out onto the beach, he's walking away from Hollywood. We know that Lipnick won't let him do anything else. Anything that he does is going to be owned by the studio, but the studio's never going to do anything. He's essentially, I guess, clear of the murder of Audrey. We don't really know. He seems to be clear of Charlie at this point. He's kind of clear of everything. So he sits down on the beach, and it just so happens that this fictional thing that he's been looking at becomes a reality in front of his head. Right in front of his head, with, you know, the Pelican dive bombing into the ocean, you know, the reality. You know, it just to me, again, this is Joel and Ethan playing with this notion of what do we do when we watch movies? You know, it's escapism, but it also is looking at human truths and human reality, but it's a frame of something. What do we do with it after it stops? Because that's how that movie stops. It's just, you're looking at that image of her with her hand up to her hair, looking out over the ocean, the dive bomb happens, end. Black. It's just kind of, to me, it's just kind of poetic and perfect, what I think they're trying to say there.
Yeah, now that you've kind of explained it, I can kind of see it, like, the way, the escapism and the frame, and even, like, once again, is the people who are making this picture, going back to Barton Fink, are they really understanding of, once again, what the common man wants? Is this a movie that this the escapism that they want, or do they want something more challenging, or they just want something less challenging? Something to tune their brain off.
Right, and something that I'm looking at, because I'm looking at the cast list on Barton Fink on IMDb, the two detectives that Charlie ventilates, their names are Mastrionati and Deutsch. So one of them is an Italian, and one of them, his literal name is German, and that's the one that he says Heil Hitler to before he blows him away.
Yeah, interesting. I forgot about
that. So that's even more sort of leaning into that whole World War II thing, which, again, is not incredibly explicit in this, but when you look at it, it's right there.
Yeah, and then you got another element I think we forgot to bring up was there's sort of a bit of, I don't know, I guess I would say sexual tension between John Goodman and John Turturro. We get the one scene when John Goodman shows him how to do the wrestling move, and they're, and then that plays back in the scene when it's like, the detectives are interrogating Fink, and do you guys do anything together? It's like, they're implying that they're gay, and he says, we're not gay, we're men, we wrestled. And there's just this awkward silence, and like, you're a real sick you-know-what, Fink.
Yeah, and another thing, too, I mean, there's some really interesting things that Charlie says. Like, he says, at one point that he's asking Bart, are you married? Oh, you got a girl somewhere? And he says, I've never had any problems in that department, kind of like he's got a girl in every port. And then he gets on a picture as if you're going to see a picture of him and a girl. And it's just a picture of him in front of a car, no girl, but he says that a girl took the picture. And then he does that thing where he flips up the bottom of his tie and there's a half-naked girl at the bottom of his tie. And he says something like, ouch. And he's looking for Barton's reaction, and Barton just kind of turns away embarrassed. So, given that we don't see a lot from Barton, or at least Charlie doesn't see a lot from Barton as far as him being all that interested in women, and the weirdness of the sex scene between him and Audrey, I mean, she leans over and kisses him. He's just kind of there, and it's almost kind of like he then faces forward and then goes and kind of reclines back really, really slowly on the bed, looking at her as if to say, is this the right move to make? I mean, you get the idea that he's either a virgin or really hasn't had much relationships with women. So, we're not really sure, and he cries, and with Charlie, he's like, you're the only person I know. Even before when he finds out that Charlie's going to leave town, he says, I'm really going to miss you. You're the only person that I know around here. And Charlie has to say, no, it's okay, partner, I'm coming back. Don't worry about it. But you do get this idea that it is Charlie is the one that kills him, because the shot that you were mentioning before where you pan up from the bed, go into the bathroom and down the pipe. Well, we know Charlie's got this issue with his hearing, and he hears things that, he can hear the people above and two doors down. He's just got the super sensitive hearing. And the idea that, Barton and Audrey got together, that's getting in between him and Charlie. And the next thing we know, she ends up dead.
And even the scenes, especially at night when they're just, in their pajamas and they're not, fully dressed, and even, they're all sweating. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you have to then wonder, okay, so if Charlie was the one that killed Audrey, what would have been his motivation for doing so? Even if he's Madman Munt, and even if he goes and ventilates people and takes their heads and whatever, what would be his motivation for doing that? With Barton in the room, I mean, he obviously had to have either knocked Barton out or given him something. Because if you're eviscerating someone next to you in a bed, not that that's happened to me, but I'm pretty sure it would probably wake you up.
Yeah.
So either he's drugged them or something. Or it may be, I mean, a lot of people don't put this theory forward, but maybe Barton killed her. I mean, he kind of wakes up from what looks like he's passed out and sees the mosquito, hits the mosquito, and then all the blood starts to seep out. Well, maybe he killed her and just blacked the whole thing out. We don't know.
I tend to be more thinking it was John Goodman. I think that's what the movie's more implying to.
So here's a crazy theory. Or I won't say it's crazy because the person that came up with it was saying it wasn't me. But it's kind of like this person I was talking to has a theory about this movie, and it's very similar to Fight Club, where you have the narrator. The narrator creates this alter ego, Tyler Durden, to do the things he can't do. So here's a guy that's really lonely. Suddenly Charlie comes along. He has a friend. Charlie can't tell him his stories because Barton doesn't know the stories to fill in those blanks. And Charlie is the one, the Charlie version of him or part of him, kills Audrey while John Turturro is quote-unquote blacked out. And the whole section with the cops is yet another part of Barton Fink's imagination.
Huh. It's interesting. I'm not sure if I can get on board with that, because you even see all the... What about all the pictures of Charlie and...
Well, again, if you've invented Charlie, then all those pictures are part of your imagination. I don't necessarily buy it completely either, because my thing was that, well, if Barton is really all that creative with an imagination that can make imaginary friends that kill people, why can't he write a wrestling picture?
Yeah. Okay, one thing I got to ask. Was there ever such a genre back in, like, the golden age of Hollywood as wrestling pictures, or did they just make that up? Because I don't remember.
No, there actually was not, it would be more like a B subgenre, and this whole thing that they're talking about where you have the guy, and he either befriends a woman or an orphan. You have a good wrestler and a bad wrestler. Yeah, there were movies like that. I have seen a couple, not a ton, but a couple. And I've actually even seen them cross as women wrestler and women wrestler pictures. Not that I've done a lot of that, but there's some MST3Ks that are like that. But I think overall, this is just another way for the Coens to poke fun at stuff, to say, well, a lot of things that are popular is all about... there's a good guy and a bad guy. The good guy either befriends a child or gets a love interest, and eventually the good guy is able to get over on the bad guy. That's 92% of movies.
Good point.
So there were wrestling pictures and sports pictures. I mean, they had a couple that were, you know, like baseball pictures that were like that. You know, the sporting genre of pictures hasn't always been, like, huge, huge blockbuster success, but they've been there, and people can very easily relate to them because they're just kind of archetypes.
Yeah, because, I mean, I was thinking, like, maybe they're implying, like, boxing pictures. That makes more sense. But, like, the way they talk about in the movie, they're acting like, oh, we come out with, like, they're like Westerns, like, they come out with, like, hundreds every year.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't say that it went to nearly that scope. You know, Westerns were way, way popular, but there were some. There weren't, like, they weren't cranking them out every day. Wallace Beery is definitely an actual actor, so that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
They weren't the dime a dozens that came out. But again, I think that's just Joel and Ethan having a giggle, you know, saying, you know. There was a lot, and gosh, it starts ramping up, obviously, after the beginning of World War II, where there's so many patriotic soldier pictures where you have a good guy,
a good guy,
and
bad
a bad guy.
guy.
probably going to have a love interest somewhere,
yeah,
or
maybe have to save
a child. Yeah. And the good guy wins.
Yep. Okay, then, so getting close to the end of my questions, is there anything else you want to bring up? One thing I asked is, like, okay, so I've seen pretty much all the Coen brothers movies except Intolerable Cruelty and The Lady Killers.
Now I saw The Lady Killers over the summer.
Yeah, and I know those are considered their worst. So what are the ones you, what are, like, your favorites, and what are the ones you just can't stand?
Well, I will always have a soft spot in my heart for this movie because of when I saw it and how much it impacted me. It's just a great movie for me. I used to like Raising Arizona a lot more when I was younger. Now it just seems a little bit too spazzy and is kind of really kind of cranking things up to 11, which I know that's what their intention was, and some of the camera movement and the noise and the use of music in that movie. So it's not like I don't appreciate Raising Arizona. I do. And Holly Hunter is just so adorable in that.
Yeah.
But and I've seen Fargo so many times, it's almost something I can sleepwalk through.
Yeah, I can quote that movie almost word for word.
Yeah. I mean, I will never, ever turn off if it is on in a room, and I would just stop what I'm doing and sit down. The Big Lebowski.
Oh, yeah.
I can't not watch that movie.
Have you seen the Fargo TV series?
No, I haven't.
It's actually,
I heard it's good.
It's really solid. The second season, I'll make a bold statement here. I'll even say the second season is every bit as good as the movie.
Oh, really?
Because, like, it's kind of anthology. So there's three seasons. They're going to be doing a fourth soon. There's three seasons, and each season is a different story.
Oh, okay.
And they're not really,
I've heard really good things.
Yeah, they're not really connected to the movie except for one really big but also somewhat an unimportant part in the first season. I won't tell you what it is, but you'll figure it out easily once you see it.
And isn't, like, Ewan McGregor in one of them and he plays two separate characters?
Yep, that's the third season.
Yeah, I've heard that's really good.
The second season, in my opinion, is the best. It's, like, it takes place in, like, the late 70s. You got Kirsten Dunst in it. Ted Danson, like, I'm not going to say too much, but it's...
Ted Danson, really?
Yeah, it's definitely a must-watch. The second season is the best, I think.
Okay, and then I would say, really, seriously, there's a few movies out there that are literally masterclasses in how you make movies, and that's what No Country for Old Men is for.
Definitely.
I mean, that movie is just so good on so many different levels. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah. So for me, I would say, The Big Lebowski, next to The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, The Big Lebowski is my second all-time favorite movie.
Nice.
That was the movie. I saw it, like, senior year in high school. And that was kind of one of the films. That was my first Coen Brothers film. And that was sort of one of the films that actually kind of really got me into movies, where I started taking film classes, started studying film, doing all sorts of things. So that was probably definitely my favorite. As far as, like, least favorites, I'm not that huge on A Serious Man. I saw it once.
No, I don't like it either.
Didn't really care for that one. I wasn't that... I thought Hail Caesar was fine. I wasn't that high on it either.
Well, I'll tell you what, I've only seen it once, and I loved it. Because for me, again, it's one of these inside baseball movies where you have... Like, to me, it made a lot of sense. People were like, I don't know why it keeps jumping around on the timeline of the story, and they'll, like, leave the story alone for these huge gaps and everything. But to me, that's the Coen brothers having, like, the ultimate amount of fun with all genres in the same movie. Like, that's, to me, like, even though it doesn't necessarily have a great through line, I love watching them. Make Channing Tatum do a dance and song number. I mean, come on, that is awesome. That is so awesome. Or Jonah Hill and Scarlett Johansson doing this whole film noir send-up. It's so much fun to watch that movie. I'm not saying it's great, but I flipping love that movie.
I do love the wood that it were so simple scene. That part always gets me laughing.
Yeah.
Let's see, and there's True Grit is one I think that's even better than the original. I really like True Grit.
I did too. I've only seen it when it was in the movie theater. Like, I haven't seen it since, but I remember thinking that, yeah, same with me. I liked it better than the original.
And then I remember Inside Llewyn Davis, the first time I watched it, I didn't really care for it that much. But then the second time I watched it, I like did a 360, and I'm like, oh, this is really good.
Well, what hooked you then?
Maybe I was able to connect with Llewyn Davis a little bit more, because the first time I thought he was just a jerk and kind of deserved everything that was coming to him because he just treated everyone like crap. I don't know, the second time, I like that whole journey he goes to when he goes to Chicago and he has to, you know, hitch a ride with John Goodman and his writer, and then he goes to, you know, meet F. Murray Abraham to play the song for him. He gives it his all, and then the guy just bluntly says, I don't see any money in this. And just, man, it's just like he goes through all that and he just get bluntly yeah. says, like, you know, I'm not going to make any money off this, so why should I hire you?
Right. Yeah. For me, I love Oscar Isaacs. I think he is a great, great actor. I have not been able to get into that movie. I just can't. I'm not a really big music person, so...
Oh, the music is fantastic. I love the soundtrack.
Yeah, but I don't care.
What about Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Do you feel the same?
Yeah. You know what? That also works for me. Even though it is an absolutely beautiful movie, it's one of the first movies that ever had a color time scheme. Mm-hmm. So every single frame is a digital effect, which, you know, Roger Deakin. But... I love The Odyssey. I've never been able to get into Oh Brother, Where Art Thou. So those are two movies that maybe, like, if I had to group two movies together that I'm like, I'm all in for, it would be the Hail Caesar, Barton Fink, doubling, and then music lovers can watch Llewyn Davis and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou.
Yeah. Oh, one other one I want to get to, because I think this one always gets kind of panned as some of their, so I know, one of the Coen brothers' films that sort of gets thrown under the rug a bit is Hudsucker Proxy, and I kind of enjoyed that movie. What did you think?
Yeah, I liked it. And in fact, I probably liked it more than just a little bit liked it. I like Tim Robbins. I like Paul Newman. I the whole thing, I think the art direction is really great in it. The goofiness of this one idea, a hoop, a circle, one of the things that's been around forever that's supposed to, like, revolutionize.
Yeah, you know, for kids.
Yeah, it's just, yeah. It's so, there's something about that movie that's kind of sweet in a way that a lot of Coen Brothers movies aren't.
Mm, yeah.
And one caveat to this, I still need to watch Blood Simple, which I will be doing in the next few weeks, and I have not watched Miller's Crossing, which I do need to watch as well. So,
okay, I like
me leaving those two out isn't because I don't have an opinion, it's because I don't have an opinion yet.
Okay. Okay, well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been discussing the 1991 film Barton Fink, directed by the Coen brothers. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Director. Be sure to listen on Dragon Digital Radio to hear the show a week before they're on Podbean. Professor Dutter, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
No problem.
All right, for the Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying, look upon me, I'll show you the life of the mind.